With episode 3620 of the Survival Podcast, and I'm a couple minutes late and got a little bit behind the scene action going on here. So I screwed up and I didn't do an audio check before I went live. So if anybody in the live stream can let me know how I sound, that would be great. That way, if there is a problem, I know about it. Sometimes there's a problem and nobody tells me, and then I get the download after and convert it to audio. And I'm like, what the hell, man? Let me know if there's a problem. I don't think there is, because, oh, no video. What the hell? How is there no video? Okay, this is new. Nope, there it is. Okay, it came up. The video came out. And nothing I did. I was looking at settings. All right, so we are live and we have video. Let me get a thing up over here, and I usually have Rumble going on over here anyway, and sorry for said being a little bit behind. Okay, so the video looks like absolute dog shit on Rumble. How's my video here over on YouTube? It looks good on my end. Fuzzy, okay. So I don't know what to do about that. Fuzzy like 240p. I would just restart the stream, but the problem with that is that it would have to be completely new streams. So let's try just simply dropping down to a 480p and see if that clears things up. And I'll have to run with it from there and just see how it goes. All right, so what are we going to talk about today now that we got that crap out of the way? And we are going to talk about a bunch of feedback from you guys. And I'm going to swap things over here so I can see my outline. But we're going to talk about some Bitcoin topics. I got like four, but it won't take very long. We'll just blow through them. And so we'll just have to wait on the video, Nurse Wang. There's nothing I can do from here. I just have to roll on with it. But we're going to talk about Bitcoin crashing. It's in the $90,000 range. Whatever, man. El Salvador, did they bend the knee to the IMF? Not really. We'll talk about the same people shrieking right now were the ones that were shrieking about it in the first place, and the parts that changed are the parts they were shrieking about in the first place, and they didn't like it, but now they're mad that it went away. I really don't know how to help people like this. All I'm going to say is in the Bitcoin space, what was an asset is becoming a liability, and that is the autism force is strong among Bitcoiners. And that was necessary early on, but we need to kind of adapt to the real world a little bit, guys. And we'll talk about that today, along with, a simple question. What would happen to a business with high cash flow requirements that was taking Bitcoin last week that has to make payroll this week from last week's money? And somebody on Noster told me businesses don't run that way. This is a person who's never run a fucking business in their life that had like a payroll and a supply chain, because every business runs this way. In fact, most businesses have to add to that a revolving line of credit to bridge gaps. I used to run a company with about 50-plus employees in it and 2,500 contractors, and I can tell you what last week would have done to me if we were even making 25-30% of our sales in Bitcoin and keeping it there. It would have bankrupted us. I would have had to go to the bank begging for money. And this is not a bad time. There's times when it just keeps getting hammered down. There's a reality here we'll talk a little bit about. Divine there is doing it right with how to ask a question. Make sure you follow that if you are in the live stream. Then we also have a Nobel laureate named Eugene Fama, and he predicted Bitcoin will go to $0 within 10 years. This is a prediction that was laughed at 10 years ago, and today should be mocked. But there's something more important than the headline. There's something else he said. It tells you that this is not a claim, this is a wish, and there's a reason for the wish, and that tells you everything, and it should make you more bullish than you've ever been. Then we're going to talk about biochar. Biochar can convert chromium 6 to chromium 3. Why does that matter? You'll hear. It's a big freaking deal. It's like biochar saving the world. Again, thoughts on sizing ponds and annual precipitation. This is going to be a brief overview. I'm going to recommend to this person that if you really aren't sure, you get an engineer involved. When you start moving large forces of water and earth, You should have somebody that knows how to do the math check it, but I can give you some general like ideas. What should you do if a bioreactor doesn't get very hot? You're making bioreactor compost. It only gets about 110, 120 degrees. Actually, not much. I'll explain. Using a cover crop for erosion control after earthworks. We'll talk about that one a little bit. Will there be primary hell to pay if certain members of the Orange Man's presumed cabinet do not get confirmed by the Senate? And the three big ones that are in question right now are Tulsi, RFK, and Kash Patel. I'll give you my rankings on who I think is least likely to get confirmed, most likely to get confirmed. And I'll also tell you that all of them will have blowback, but there's one of them that will have blowback that anybody voting against this person, especially a Republican, really, if you want a future at all in politics, you need to think about what you're doing right now. And I bet many of you can guess which one I'm talking about. We'll also talk about storing ammo when you've got humidity concerns. Wired, who's supposed to be doing articles on like technology, they're literally throwing text-based tantrums over what Doge is doing. I'll tell you about that. It's fantastic to watch. It's literally the left becoming a snake and eating itself from the tail up to its own head. It's wonderful. Then biochar. Another question on biochar. What about using it in wicking beds? We'll talk about where it goes and where it probably shouldn't go in a wicking bed. And then we'll talk about why I don't care that we're tariffing Mexico and Canada and why you shouldn't either. And since I wrote that bullet point, somebody caved. Somebody caved. Was it the South of the Border friends or was it maple syrup Castro? I'll tell you when we get to it. And then we're going to talk a little bit about how evil the U.S. really is, along with the IMF and the World Bank and all our allies in well-developed countries, especially the EU and Britain. And we're going to talk about it from a monetary standpoint. Like when you hear Bitcoiners say, fix the money, fix the world, it's more than you know. And I'm going to give you a great book to either read or listen to in audio. If you listen to the audio version of this book, it is narrated by my good personal friend, Guy Swan, the guy who knows more and has read more about Bitcoin than just about anybody else you would ever know. Anyway, Tom says maple syrup Castro is effing funny. I thought so. It just kind of came to me on the fly answering some stuff in social media, which is where a lot of this stuff came from today. If you want to submit comments, questions, etc., if you're here in the live stream, just do it with the word question in all caps, just like this one here. I haven't even read it yet, but see, I saw it because it has question in all caps. You can do that here, but if you want like a main segment on a show, email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC in the subject line. Give me your question or comment in one sentence, then hit return a couple times, then give me details. You'll be highly likely to end up on the show. Yeah, Snow Mexicans, that was another one I just saw. That wasn't mine, though. Somebody else came up with that. Somebody posted a meme of Baron talking to his dad and saying, the Snow Mexicans are really mad now, big mad now. And I said when I shared that, I absolutely know that is wrong. We should not refer to Canadians and Snow Mexicans. On the other side, I can't stop laughing about it like a little kid. All right, before we get into all this, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day and a special announcement. I've mentioned this several times. I want to really start mentioning it more as we lead up to it, though. On March 21, 22, and 23, I will be part of a beef processing class at Crunchy Mama Farms. I need to put a Y in that headline there. I missed that, I guess, but it's Crunchy Mama Farms. Chef Ken Daniels and I will be there. This is going to be an awesome workshop. It's limited to 18 attendees, or maybe it's 16 attendees. I don't really remember, but it's I might have got that wrong. Anyway, you want to get a seat at this class if you want to come before it fills up. It is about an hour north of me. You can get full details by clicking on the link in my write-up on it. I am going to be there as like a guest instructor and just to help. Chef Ken is going to be there the same, but also doing things like tastings and walking you through certain pairings and stuff like that, really elevating this experience. All that is being thrown in for free. This is the same price they charge to anybody going to this class. And you're going to also leave with about 50 pounds of grass-fed beef at the end of the class. Some of the meat that we process will actually be used for some meals while we're there. All the rest of it gets divided up and sent home with students. So you want to bring a cooler for this one. Again, about 50 pounds average per student. Of course, cows vary by weight and things like that, but you're going to look at about 50 pounds of the best meat in the world going home with you, in addition to all the knowledge and the experience that you'll get at this class. So really consider it. Next up, our sponsors of the day, Anton's Land of Biltong. Talk about good meat, man. That's what, one of the things you could do with all that meat you're going to go home with if you go to that class is make some biltong. The reality, though, is you can make your own biltong, or you can just get it from a guy that makes it the right way, and Anton does. I actually trade with him for his sponsor spot, and he provides me with biltong and Drewer sausages. Every 2 weeks, I get a shipment to my house. I absolutely love it. I thought about saying, just put it all together in one big shipment. No, because I eat all of it in a few days after it shows up. So anyway, check out Anton's Land of Biltong. And if you're an MSB member, he'll give you a discount. Just log into your MSB account when you go to buy, and you'll see how to do that. Next up today, the Wealth Steading Podcast with John Pugliano. John is a great guy. He is a prepper. He's a ham radio operator. And he made himself into a liquid millionaire before he took one client as an investment manager. He also does a podcast about once a week called the Wealth Steading Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. Check it out at wealthsteading.com. With that, let's get on into this. I want to talk about a bunch of stuff today involving Bitcoin, but I don't want this to be like a mini Bitcoin breakout. And thanks, Tom, for fixing my typo there. I appreciate that. Anyway, I do want to cover some topics that are really hot right now with Bitcoin. One, it crashed. You know, I think it's, I don't even know what the price is. I don't pay attention to the price, except when I get my daily DCA alert. But I'm going to pull it up right now just so I'm not talking out of my ass with where it's at. But Bitcoin is trading at, I'm going to say 95,000, 93,000. I don't know. I'm waiting for my screen to load. 99,000. 99,000 and it crashed again. I guess there's already been a rebound since this morning and when my buy went through. Is anybody else that's been around, you know, more than like 15 minutes in the Bitcoin space amused when people say it's crashing and we're talking about the $90,000 range, anywhere between like $90,000 and 1 cent up to $99,999.99? Is it calling anything inside that bracket an absolutely ridiculous thing to refer to as crashed? But didn't we tell you long ago when Bitcoin was like under $10,000 and it had gone from like 11,000 down to like 5,000 and people shrieked it crashed, that someday Bitcoin would be like $100,000 and go into the 90s and people would say it crashed? Didn't we say that? Because this is really, really obvious to everyone. Here's the thing. Ignore this whole crash nonsense, right? Now, altcoins and shitcoins and Ethereum have taken it up the butt hard, have they not? Bitcoin just continues to destroy everything. I really invite you to get involved with my 365 DCA daily challenge. I am posting every day on X and on Noster. So either place you follow me, you can check it out. I post a screenshot of a little tiny $5 daily DCA. It is not the only thing that I do as far as buying Bitcoin, but it's a commitment. I'll go 365 days every day of 2025 buying Bitcoin. Jack, it's February. I can't participate. Yes, you can. You are a grown-ass adult with a functioning brain. You can start daily DCAing, and you can go all the way around to whatever day you start. I started back in November. I'm not counting it, though, for this. I wanted to do it as an annual thing, and I'm DCAing $5 a day. That is not a lot of money. It's $150 a month. Now, for some people, that's too much. I understand. But I've had people tell me, I do a weekly buy, man. I can't afford to do a daily DCA. And then you ask them, like, well, how much do you buy a week? And they're like, $25. Bro, get a calculator, divide by 7, and do it as daily just for the fun of it and just to get more volatility into your dollar cost averaging. It will change. I'm telling you, I thought it was a dumb thing when I set it up. And I was going to figure out how much money I usually spend on Bitcoin per month, do the division thing, and have a bigger buy. And I was a little bit hesitant with that. And I still like kind of like having some powder for when there's a big dip to go in and buy more. So I just decided to go with $5, but it was amazing how that little buy changed everything. When I get up and Bitcoin's down, I'm like, woohoo, it's fun. It's like when you're buying the dip all the way down in the accumulation trough, except you're doing it all the time. Next, El Salvador. So there's a bunch of Bitcoin maxis, influencers, that's what I call them, not influencers, influencers. there's a lot going on in Bitcoin right now with the people that have the loudest microphones. I'm not unaware of the irony of me saying that, but I don't consider myself a Bitcoin influencer. I consider myself a multi-topic podcaster. The people that I'm talking about generally don't have anything to talk about at all except Bitcoin and maybe some, you know, macroeconomic and microeconomic stuff outside of Bitcoin. They're certainly not going to be telling you about biochar or, you know, they're going to do a whole episode on cover crops or how to cook food or how to be keto, right? They're kind of tight focused. And those people are tight focused, I think, mainly because there's a lot of autism. And I'm talking about my form of autism. I am autistic because somebody decided to change Asperger's to simply a form of autism instead of leaving it to be its own unique condition. And if you go look at the characteristics of an Aspie, as it used to be called, I am textbook, especially if you go back to when I was like 10 years old. And there's a power to this kind of functional autism in that you can focus on a thing and you generally have a pretty good intellect and you can just nail that thing hard. But the problem is it often goes over to a form of OCD. And then because I believe this thing, everybody else should believe it. And so El Salvador, with what they did a couple of years ago, they made Bitcoin legal tender. They told everybody in the country, you can use Bitcoin. There's a free wallet provided by El Salvador, the country. They started buying. They did a lot of different things with Bitcoin. All of it, in my opinion, was good. The funny thing is there's a couple things that they did that the same people shrieking now about them not doing it anymore were the ones shrieking the loudest about why they shouldn't do it in the first place. You can't make this up. So the legal tender thing meant that anybody anywhere doing business in El Salvador had to allow someone else to pay with Bitcoin. Now, the way they did it and set it up with a Lightning wallet, if I was spending Bitcoin because I wanted to and you didn't want Bitcoin, I was buying pupusas or tacos or something from you from your little stand on the beach. Well, your free wallet that came from El Salvador or any wallet you wanted to use, you didn't have to use that wallet. Like a Strike type service would allow you to receive dollars. So I could spend Bitcoin and you could get dollars. But they didn't like that. They said, no one should tell people, and I agree with this, right? No one should tell people that they have to accept any form of payment. Okay. The other thing was, because it was legal tender, you could pay your income tax in El Salvador with Bitcoin. Those are the things that really went away. So Bukele needing money from the IMF, we'll talk about that's bookending this, by the way. We'll talk about that at the end. Video's down again. I can't do anything, guys, with the video. All I can do is roll on at this point. I don't know what the problem is. Listen to the audio. Hopefully the video will be back up by the time I'm doing screenshots. But El Salvador also said that you were able to pay your taxes in Bitcoin since it was legal tender. To make this deal go through with the IMF, what they had to do was agree to certain things. And one was to remove the concept of this legal tender law in El Salvador. And Bukele said, fine, we need money. We want to develop all of this gold that we found, basically. They want to mine gold. And so, okay, we'll do it. Now, how does this actually – now, again, the people are shrieking now. Hey, Bethany, he gave in. He's a cock, whatever. Like, okay, they're the same fucking people that said the things that they're crying about now never should have been in place in the first place. But let's look at – how does this affect anything? Anybody in El Salvador can still accept Bitcoin. Anybody that wants to spend Bitcoin with anybody that accepts Bitcoin can still spend Bitcoin. And there's still no capital gains tax. So what changed? The practical nature of what changed is nothing. And that's why Bukele, not being fucking autistic like some of you are, said, fine, fuck it, I don't care. This doesn't really affect people, so I don't give a fuck. What about the paying your taxes in Bitcoin? Who the fuck wants to do that? Nobody wants to spend their Bitcoin on taxes. Unless what? You owe them fucking money. They're gonna fuck you up if you don't pay them. And the only place you can get the money is from your Bitcoin stash. So you're like, I'll sell Bitcoin to pay my taxes. What's the problem with that? Let's say your Bitcoin's in the money. Now you sell Bitcoin in early 2025 to pay 2024's taxes, and you add to your tax bill on capital gains because you sold Bitcoin to pay your taxes. But if you live in a country where there's no capital gains tax on Bitcoin, that doesn't fucking matter. So again, it doesn't fucking matter. And I'm going to bet you, I just bet you that El Salvador will accept dollars as payment and allow you to spend it into dollars. If they don't, I don't care. Right? It doesn't really matter. But my big thing is here, you have to be careful who you listen to in this space, because there are a shitload of fucking people out there right now. And I mean a shitload of people in Bitcoin, specifically in this area of Bitcoin, who really are out of touch with reality. And they just want something to complain about, and they want everybody to do it their way. You know, here's how I look at it. Everything that's going on with Bitcoin right now says that everybody in the world is about to start using it. These people have been shrieking, Bitcoin for all, freedom for all, for like 12 years. I'll give them props for that. Now some of the people are saying, yeah, we're going to use Bitcoin. And they're like, you're using it the wrong way. You can only use it the way we want you to use it. Again, the autism is strong. I'm sorry, it is. Then one of the places these autistic folks are, and I want to go real quick here, but they're really, really super OCD autistic in this place, is that everybody should be spending their Bitcoin all the time. You should like use Strike Bill Payer, pay every bill of Bitcoin or whatever. And I keep trying to explain to these people, and you can tell, none of them have ever run a company with a payroll. That's one thing you know. They've never run a company with a payroll, and they've never run a company with a hardcore supply chain. And most of them have never run a company that they actually derive their primary income from. So maybe they have, you know, a little side business selling beef jerky that they heat up with Bitcoin miners or something. They only take Bitcoin payment, or they're making herbal salves out of 90% of the shit comes from their backyard or something. But what they don't have to do is buy all the pieces and parts, track the profit, and have to deal with the volatility on the interim of the supply chain lag from order, delivery, and then counter order and delivery of product on the out. And they certainly have not run a payroll. Well, I put this on Noster recently, and somebody said, no business is running on the, you know, running on the cash flow from last week, this week. Okay, tell me you've never run a fucking business with cash flow ever in your life without saying it, because you just did. Every fucking business of any fucking size is running on the cash flow this week to next week. Always. The reason they have revolving lines of credit is sometimes you need bridges between a big week and a little week. It happens all the time. But this is with known fixed profit margins. So I ask you a question, some of you spreadsheet wizards. Let's say you were running a significantly sized business with a gross margin or a net profit of about 5%, and you took the money in last week and you got to pay it out this week. Oh, by the way, just so you know, sometimes bills come due. And for instance, when we were running the company that I was talking about earlier, this contract agency called Data Workforce, we had about 2,500 deployed contractors at any given time. Sometimes it was 3,000, sometimes it was 1,800. But our aggregate average, we had a payroll to meet weekly of payments for times for their hours plus per diem, because most of them were out of, you know, they were travelers. That's how this business ran. And we had to make that payment every week. We had over 50 employees we had to make payments to biweekly, but our electric bill was between $8,500 and $12,500 a month for our officer. Oh, then we had about $25,000 in rent that we had to pay the building owner that we were occupying, because we were actually running multiple companies inside that space that we ran. We had a very big space. We had a whole floor of this giant-ass building up in Frisco. If I would have been running that business on Bitcoin over the last few weeks, I would have gotten my ass kicked, and I would have been out of business and unable to make payroll without going into debt, without going into significant debt beyond my normal revolving line of credit from our bank. Because that's just how the numbers work, dummy. There are so many businesses out there that they're measuring their profit in between 1.5 and 8%. And they need the money to be there week to week to week. They only have so much in reserve. And once you put Bitcoin into a stack, you don't want to pull it back out, especially if you understand why you did it in the first place. So the only way this can be done, companies on a Bitcoin standard is what this guy said, they would have done really well. Again, no idea how a business runs. The way you run a Bitcoin standard for a company today, especially a non-public company where you just can't issue debt and use it to buy Bitcoin, what you have to do is you have to be a ruthless manager of fiat cash flow, your dollars. You have to absolutely know this surplus capital can be swept into Bitcoin holdings. And I am unlikely to need it for at least a quarter, at least a quarter. And then you can run that way. Anything else is nonsense. Anybody that tells you it can be done has never done it. And you can't show me anybody doing it now. And I'm telling you, the few big companies out there that actually take Bitcoin right now, they're not taking Bitcoin. You pay in Bitcoin, they get dollars. There's some sort of atomic or automatic swap on the back end going USDT or something like that, or straight up dollars. I guarantee you that. I guarantee you that. I guarantee you that 100%. Because when you run a business like this, the day to pay the bill comes, and it doesn't care that, oh, in a couple weeks it'll be all right. You know what happens when you don't pay a contractor in the Philippines or Malaysia or Greece or even Canada or California and your office is in Dallas? All your contractors find out and they walk the job. They just leave and you're fucked. And your customers say, fuck you. We can't count on you to do what you said you'd do. That's what happens. And that business didn't even have a supply chain. I mean, other than like toner for the printer and shit. We didn't have any widgets that were going out the door. Imagine taking a company that size that sells a physical product and doing this. You're dead. So please stop saying it and point out to people who keep saying it. Please show me a company doing it. They'll never show you a company doing it because it doesn't exist, because it is a death sentence. It's a death sentence. Imagine doing it when we went from 69,000 on the second peak of the last cycle all the way down to 14.4. Imagine that. Or was it 15.2? I said 14.4. It ended up being like 15.2. Imagine what a beating that that company would have never made it. It would have never survived. Grocery stores, by the way, are running on a 1.5% net profit. You think that's going to work out? It's not. I'm sorry. Okay, moving on real quick. This guy, Nobel laureate Eugene Farmer, predicts Bitcoin will go to zero in 10 years. And it looks like I'm still freaking hazy as shit. So I'm going to ignore that, and I'm not going to bring it up for you. I'm just going to read it to you. Anyway, Stephen Lupka, works for Swan Bitcoin, I had him on the show a while ago. He says, this is a profound self-own, as it shows he cares more about the consistency of theory than truth. No intellectual worth their salt would hope something fails because its success would mean your assumptions are wrong. So here's what this guy, he's a Nobel laureate. Right. Like, these are the same people that signed letters about, you know, the economy crashing in 2016 if Trump won and the economy exploded until COVID shut up. These people know nothing. They have no credibility. But in a moment of honesty during this interview where the headline is Bitcoin's going to zero, he said the persistence of Bitcoin poses a challenge to established economic principles. I'm hoping it will bust. Wait a minute. You just said it would. You declared it with all your credentials. This guy's also like a fossil. I mean, we're all getting older. One day I'll be a fossil, hopefully, because if you're not a fossil, that means you didn't get to grow old. But there is a point where, like, you're the old guard. Shut up and go, like, retire, feed seagulls ice cream, right? I'm hoping it will bust, Fama said, because if it doesn't, you have to start all over with monetary theory. He suggests that if Bitcoin maintains its value long term, didn't we launch Bitcoin in 2008? Somebody send this old man a memo. All right. If it holds its value long term, economists would need to fundamentally rethink their understanding of money and markets. My response to this is yes, and it's about time. It's about time. Can you imagine that situation? Now, TN Permaculture says a lot of YouTube has been hazy today. Simply Bitcoin was unwatchable. But I don't think it's YouTube. I think it's something else because it looks like shit on Rumble too. Anyway, we'll just keep powering through again. Guys, I'm sorry about the video. There's nothing I can do about it. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you about some other stuff today other than just Bitcoin. But imagine that you got an economist so well known that he's a Nobel laureate. And he's rooting for Bitcoin to fail because if it doesn't fail, him and all his cronies have to rewrite the rules of economics. In other words, they fabricated a reality of money that's not true, and a natural form of money, because that's what Bitcoin is. It is a natural form of money. I know we made it, but a finite, limited resource that cannot be artificially inflated is money in its natural form. That would be the best money. That would be the natural type of money. because it, when that happens, then, oh shit, our MMMT did not work, right? Our modern monetary theory just went out the fucking window. Our fiat theories just went out the window. Again, I'm going to give you a great book to check out, to learn more about this. And do what Jeff says. I am one-eyed man, one-man show today. If you do not put question in all caps, I will not see it, and I will not get you in Q&A. All right, so let's talk about biochar, though. So I don't see any reason to bring up on the screen the screenshot of it, since the video quality is still ass. Let's see if that's – yeah, it is. Okay. So here's the headline of the article, though. And this was just released January 31st, 2025, just last week. Organic material can convert toxic heavy metal to a harmless form. Researchers from the University of Waterloo have discovered that a special form of charcoal, that would be biochar, is highly effective at absorbing toxic chromium and transforming it to a safer form. Chromium is a heavy metal that exists in two forms. One form is chromium-3, a safe micronutrient your body needs. The other is chromium-6, a dangerous carcinogen linked to ovarian, lung, and liver cancer and reproductive problems. The upshot of this is that biochar, specifically made from oak-based biochar, was able in this research and in this study to actually convert chromium-6 into chromium-3. So chromium-6 is bad shit. It is a horrible thing. You do not want it in your body. It's a terrible thing. If it gets into your water supply, it's very difficult to remove with all but the best filters. It's bad. Chromium-3, some people are taking in their multivitamins. You realize this. And simply by allowing the chromium-6 to be adsorbed into biochar, the resulting conversion to chromium-3 means it's now a mineral that can be used by people and taken up by plants. So when we think about biochar, one of the things we want to be concerned with is, like, if we use it to remediate things like heavy metals, then those heavy metals are in that biochar forever. What I've always said is that's not really worth worrying about, because it's already there before you added the biochar, and it's not going anywhere even without it. And that the plants will not use the energetic process necessary to break the adsorption bond and pull it out of the charcoal if they don't want it or need it, because it's an energetic process. Kind of like, the word went out of my head right now. Gluconeogenesis in the human body, where protein, yes, can be converted into sugars, but the body will only do it if it needs the carbohydrate. It won't do it on all the protein that goes in the body. It doesn't work that way. So this is pretty amazing. And Nurse Wang, and I don't consider myself a religious person, okay? But I do believe in a creator, a God. I'm a deist. And Nurse Wang says, isn't God's design amazing? And that's kind of where I'm going with it. Here's how I look at this as a nature-centric deist. Any natural problem probably has a natural solution. Any natural problem for life on this planet probably has a natural solution. Anything that is naturally created as a toxin or a problem probably has a natural agent that can convert it to something that isn't. Because if we didn't have that, and that would either be evolutionary adaptation of the organism that was adversely affected. In other words, we evolved to actually not be hurt by a thing, or nature evolves to correct the imbalance so that we're not harmed. And I think that's exactly what this is. Biochar, as we think of it, that we make it, is a kind of expensive commodity. It takes some work and energy to make it. But in the natural fire cycles, charcoal's made all over the planet all the time. I have a whole chapter in my coming course on biochar that's just the natural fire cycle and how important it is to life on the planet as a whole. So this is a completely natural solution to an actual natural problem. Now, we can artificially create more chromium-6 to worry about through doing dumb shit, but chromium-6 is a natural product as well. In the amount that it's created, probably in nature, there's enough balance with things like this to render it inert or become actually helpful as a nutrient. I agree, isn't God's design amazing? And I fundamentally believe that there is an architect and a creator beyond this, behind this universe, because it's too elegant, it's too perfect, it's too beautiful to happen by accident. I'm sorry if you believe that. God bless you, even though you don't believe in God. That's all I'll say, you know. Or if you really push the issue, I might just say, well, bless your heart. Anyway, moving on. Thoughts on sizing ponds and annual precipitation. This person wrote me, you know, about hard catchment and soft catchment and how much rainfall they get, and should their pond be as big as that number for that location, or bigger or smaller. I want to try to give you the best explanation I can for this without actually acting as a remote consultant who has to step foot on your land and doesn't know if you're going to, like, send a giant mudslide down the hill into your neighbor's house. So whenever you start looking at putting ponds in, especially if you've never done it before and you've never worked with an engineer before, and you get up over the size of like 2,500 to 5,000 gallons, you get up beyond what somebody would put a lined koi pond in as, right? And you expect that pond to work from natural catchment, not being refilled from a well or something like that, and then to be able to handle overflow and discharge, things like that, you probably should get some help of an experienced pond builder who's done it before, because you're starting to play around with forces that you may not understand. And anybody can go down to their local shop and rent an excavator up to about 8,000 to 10,000 pounds without special paperwork. Once you get over that, because it's really expensive, they want insurance, usually have to be a company, but that's a pretty big machine, or a Bobcat or something like that. And you can move a lot more earth than you think, and you can do it right, and you can do it almost right, and you can do it wrong. Wrong is generally not that big of a problem, because wrong usually results in immediate failure, and it never becomes catastrophic because it never has a chance to. In other words, your pond doesn't fill, it drains, and then you just spend a lot of money, and your disaster only affects you. Almost worked. Almost worked is where, you know, 6 months in, you're like, oh, that's a beautiful pond. And then, like, 14 months in, when there's a major catastrophic rain event, and then a big problem. So let's start with get some help. But here's one of the things. So this individual said they have about 50,000 gallons of catchment. I have no idea how they calculated that based on the, you know, the porosity of the earth, how much infiltrates, how much moves across, et cetera, plus other structures. I think they're thinking about rooftops and stuff like that here. A lot of this, though, like if you want more catchment, simple little, like not micro, but small scale swales can radically increase your catchment and change your location of overflow. So with a swale, which is a level ditch on contour, we can take water that comes down a hill over here that would normally just keep going, and we can move it passively over to our pond. But when that swale should have something called a sill. This is a dead level overflow point, usually at least 2 meters, about 6-7 foot wide, at least that wide, hard compacted, no mound in front of it. So when that swale is over capacity, it will really lightly sheet over and actually reduce erosion. It actually kills erosion, but cold dead if you do it right. So we can increase the catchment. That would mean we can build a bigger pond because we have more catchment, so more water. If we have hard surface runoff, we can do some things to make sure all of it ends up in the pond. And that's going to, you know, usually you're looking at like 60 percentile, depending on the surface. It could be 25% if it's sand around you, and it could be freaking 80% if it's really hard compacted land. But somewhere in the 60 percentile, usually, of whatever hits the ground that's in the catchment would end up in the pond, so we can increase that. This didn't sound like it was going to be a very big pond, something like a 50 by 50 foot structure. You probably can do this yourself, but it wouldn't hurt to have someone involved with the process that knows what they're doing. They also were not sure if their clay content was sufficient to build the pond. And, you know, there's probably a lot of opportunity there that if you paid someone to do the work for you, since you've never done it before, you probably end up with a bigger pond holding more water. That's what I'm getting at. But here's my general advice, if you can do it. Build your pond as deep as you can. The deeper your pond, the longer you will go where evaporation is not a problem, even if your shoreline decreases. and your evaporation will be less. If you have two ponds holding, let's say, 100,000 gallons of water, and one pond is 50% bigger in circumference than the other pond, so what is lacking in depth is made for an area, your evaporation will be much higher. It will be about 100% higher when you have 50% more surface area in your summer when you lack rain. So deep, get consulting, maximize catchment, know your overflow, have at least two overflows, a primary and an emergency. And it's never a bad idea with a pond to have like something like a baffled pipe put through the dam breast where water can actually be taken out the other side on demand to do things, or vented to some sort of spillway where you can actually, if you have way too much water, way too big an event, have a tertiary, a third level of discharge to prevent massive failures. Again, if any of this scares you, that's what I'm saying, to get somebody, even if they're not an engineer, at least an experienced pond builder. The size this guy's talking probably doesn't need all that. But 50,000 gallons of water is not that much when it comes to evaporation in your dry season. And anything you could do to increase your catchment and be able to make a deeper pond would probably be worth doing. And also, he didn't really say what he wants to do with it, so that has some aspects too. But experienced pond builders on site are always worth what they charge. It really is. Next up, I had a question on bioreactors, and the bioreactor was getting up like 110, 115 degrees, and they're really worried about it. I get this question all the time for my students in the bioreactor compost course. And I don't know how many times I said in the course, your thermophilic cycle will probably get between 130 and 165 degrees. But if it doesn't get up there, it's okay. Don't worry about it. I don't really know, and some of the questions are for people that didn't take the course. Okay, I get that. But my students ask this question constantly, and if they're building the bioreactor, they're getting the feedback, that means it went all the way through the course. I must have said that 10 times in the 8 hours of instruction. And I'm not picking on anybody. I'm just telling you, it's not a big deal with bioreactor compost. But it could be. My question is, did you get the material wet enough? Because I've seen plenty of people tear bioreactors apart on YouTube. And like a huge, like the core is beautiful, broke down, and the whole circumference is still dry looking material. That is inevitably because that material was not protected enough, not watered enough, and it didn't get wet enough. If you have 15 to 20% nitrogen and you're as wet as you should be and it's well distributed through your carbon, it is highly likely that you would get up over 130 degrees. However, there's another thing here. I've drilled down with some of my students and, okay, when did you take the temperature? Oh, like day 9. And you didn't take it on like day 3 and 4. No. Okay. It is very possible that you peaked at 150, 160, and you're on the way down already. These bioreactors do not stay hot a long time. This is not a thermophilic composting method. This is a static pile method, highly oxygenated, and the majority of the digestion and breakdown that occurs over a year is done by worms and other soil organisms. It is really best called a biodigester more than a bioreactor. And my freaking video feed still looks like ass. Sorry, guys. Nothing I can do about it. I think StreamYard has this problem if you're seeing it from other YouTubers today. Anyway, that's really not worth worrying about. Just don't sweat it and rock on. Next over, I had a question about cover crop for erosion control after earthworks. This person's soil was a mix of sand and clay, but it sounded like mostly sandy soil with some clay from the deeper earthwork. So this is probably an ideal situation for the guy that wanted to build a pond. You have easy to work with sand as your surface material, and then beneath it you have a nice layer of beautiful clay. And so that means we're trying to stabilize sand, let's be honest. So one of the things I would say is, this project screams for either compost or hydromulch as a harrow. So you put your seed down and then put either a hydromulch or a harrowing of good quality compost, best case scenario, with maybe 5% biochar mixed in it on top of it, and you want the cover crop to germinate as rapidly as possible. You want a mixture of root types, and you want fast-growing annuals, and you want long-term perennials, because his plan for this area that's been disturbed to maintain it isn't grazing or cropping. It's mowed a few times a year. So what that means is if we go with all annuals, when they die, we're going to get whatever weeds show up as perennials. So I get this all the time. What mix should I use? And I understand this. When I was really young and I was learning about things like search engine optimization and stuff, and some of my mentors, I'm like, but you know what I'm trying to get traffic for? Just tell me what to do to the site. And they were telling me the techniques, not the exact form of like a description tag or a title tag or an anchored link inbound or how many, like they would just explain the structure and the game and the, you know, back then you could do a lot with on-site, on-page SEO with like keyword percentiles and things like that. And the reason they were doing that is they were good teachers. They were good mentors. I was lucky to have them. And they knew if they just told me what to do, I would do it. But they also knew that I would now not actually know how to do it. I would just be cutting and pasting. So they made me figure it out because it was the only way for me actually to know. So unless I'm like on site looking at your land, knowing exactly what you're trying to accomplish and thinking, you know, 5 years into your future, I can't just give you a list, but I can give you some ideas. And so this time of year, you want something that's going to grow fast and it's going to kind of let itself be taken over as we warm up. Annual ryegrass would be a base seed I would use in this, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% of the total mix. And then I would want to use maybe some other things that are really good at establishing roots, but will also kind of die off as an annual, white Caius oak. Those two will germinate right now in most of the country, not all of the country, most of it. If they won't do it now, they will do it soon in a few weeks. The white Caius oak will put these huge root clods in, and the annual rye will make this massive spread. But interested in that, you want long-term perennials that will help establish a base. So I would look at some sort of perennial grass in that system. I would also look at herbs and forbs like plantain would be something I'd want. I would want, frick, if it was me, I would want some tap-rooted things in there like dandelion as well. And so I would, that's the way to think about this. You know, you're not going to want to be doing a lot of buckwheat right now, you know, or red cowpea or anything like that. And that's not really what you're looking for long-term if you're going to transition into a something that's perennial in mode. That would be where to go. Now, if it was summer, then cowpea and buckwheat would be fantastic for the same application because it's the right time to grow them and then successing into herbs. I would also want clover in this mix. And I would want perennial clover, New Zealand white, Dutch white, something like that. And you might change that a little bit based on, you know, what your climate is. You might use a different clover if you're a warmer or a cooler climate. Chuck says, and I'm lucky I saw it, what do you think about daikon radish and some kind of beet in a pasture mix? So the problem with that is these are annuals and you're dealing with sand and you're going to have a big giant taproot and then it's going to die because that's what's going to happen to it. It's going to rot, leave a great big hole where you're trying to hold the earth. This is a different application. In a pasture, it's going to be grazed. And this is like one of the feedstocks in it, and it's going to open up the ground, and it's going to decompact it, and we're going to have other things coming in behind it, and we're going to long-term manage it with grazing. That's fantastic. That is fantastic. For a sandy hillside that's going to be mowed, that's a bad idea. You see what I'm saying? Like, people think plants are like, there's like some kind of like magic button that this one particular mix will do everything. It won't. That's why I put so much time, if you've taken the cover crop course, into how to develop your own mixes instead of just saying, if you live in North Carolina, plant this in the winter. Because there's 100 other variables in there besides winter and North Carolina. And this is how I'm trying to empower you guys. Moving on from there, let's talk about the election results a little bit, I guess. Not really election. The consequences of the election. Remember, Obama one time, you know, lectured the whole country by saying in his first address to the nation after being elected the first time was what? elections have consequences. And when he said that, he meant, sit down, shut up, we won, you lost, it's our way, fuck off. That's what he meant when he said it. Not a really great way to talk to people when, you know, about half the country didn't vote for you. And I don't want Trump doing that either. But the reality is elections do have consequences. And fighting policy is one thing, but the people that the president wants in his cabinet, that's a whole other thing. And right now we have three people who have had their hearings that we're not sure if they're going to get confirmed or not. They are Tulsi Gabbard, Cash Patel, RFK Jr. I think especially any Republican that votes against these people, you have signed your own letter of resignation, especially, you know, people do have short memories. So if you're not, if your next election, because senators are reelected every 6 years, right? If your next election is like 28 or you just got reelected and it's 32, you might get away with this. The senators and some of the ones on the fence are up for reelection in 26. There's certain things you can do right now that will all but ensure you get your ass primary. With RFK Jr., I think that is 2x the risk for these people. The other thing about RFK is this will play out for Democrats too. Like Cash, and I would say even though Tulsi was a Democrat, Cash and Tulsi, there's not a lot of Democratic voters I'm talking about, with real strong emotions about those two people from a positive standpoint. They made Tulsi into a traitor with words versus her actions. And they made her into a traitor less with foreign policy and more with she's an apostate from the Democrat Party. That is how she is seen. That is how she is perceived by the people that vote for wokeism and nonsense. Okay? RFK is not that in the minds of those people. RFK is a Democrat that they love, and they didn't like everything about him, but what they love most is his stance on healthcare. And he is a Democrat who has been able to worm his way into a Republican presidency, which is true. I think anybody that votes against RFK's confirmation that's invulnerable in any way, if they are up for reelection in 2026, is dead duck shit, and you deserve it. You deserve it when it happens to you. I am not political. I don't vote. You know, you guys know this. I care about this enough that while I won't vote, I might participate in a movement to get certain people fucking primaried in 26. I'm dead serious. Fundraising, phone call, all of it. Like, this is bullshit. This is absolute shit. You lost. Take the L. There's no reason not to confirm these people. Cash Patel, I think they're terrified of him. I think he's getting confirmed, though. I'm not going to spend much time on him because I think it's a non-issue. I actually think RFK is going to get confirmed. I really do. I think the person most at risk to not get confirmed is Tulsi Gabbard. Because there's so many waffly Republicans on this, but several have already kind of turned a little, like, you know, they got some phone calls and they started looking at it and they started looking at, you know, the fact that the Senate is a great place to grow old. Like, there's not a better elder care facility than the United States Congress, either as a rep or a senator. Like, it's a great place to be 85 years old. I mean, power must be a hell of a drug because I would retire. All these people are fucking rich by then. But as it goes, you know, you got complete care for everything, all of your needs. And I think it's literally becoming a retirement plan to die as a senator. And so you've got your own garage to park in. They have a gas station under fucking ground. You have your own bar. You have your own bar in your office constantly restacked. You have people kissing your fucking ass on a daily basis, both your staff and lobbyists. It's a pretty cushy life. And when you start to realize being a dick about this one issue could jeopardize all that, they actually start to fear losing their jobs. And I think this is more true of senators than reps. I think reps know that the Nancy Pelosi's of the world that have been in government since the 70s as a rep and are still here, that's unusual. Senators, because they only stand election every 6 years, because most states are freaking hardcore one side or the other. Once you're in, you can stay there till you fucking die 90% of the time. And risking that is a risk. So we'll see. But I'd like you guys to tell me right now in the live chat, which of the three do you think is most at risk of not getting confirmed? And which is most likely to get confirmed? So put like the name risk and then the name most likely or something that's pretty obvious. Let's just take a look at that and I'll move on to the next one while you guys do that. And my freaking video still looks like ass. Hopefully the audio when I download my side won't suck. I usually record on two machines, audio only on the other one. I didn't do it today. It's a freaking Monday. Started late. Everything went sideways this morning like it always does. And my grandkids aren't here today, which you think that would make me more efficient. But they do chores that I had to do. And then, you know, when Dorothy gets out of bed, then I get out of bed. So I had to set my own alarm like 30 minutes late today. So, yeah, I got behind. Some of my own doing, some of just happenstance. But I do think there will be primary hell. I mean, absolute hell if RFK is not confirmed. And I think RFK is the one. It goes beyond 26. I think that's an elephant memory for people if that is taken away from them. And here's why not to do it. This is why not to do it. Not just the decency or anything like that or because it's a good – no. Here's why you shouldn't do it as a senator. The shit you're worried about happening is going to happen anyway. All of these people serve at the pleasure of the president. This is exactly what's going to happen if they don't confirm RFK. Trump will give them somebody that they'll confirm that they can't not confirm. Trump will tell that person, you do whatever the fuck Bobby says. He'll hire Bobby as like the health czar. And he'll say, what the fuck Bobby says is what the fuck I say. And it's what I am telling you to do. So you're not going to prevent the things that are going to happen from happening anyway. But they can't learn. They haven't learned. They still don't think Trump's going to do what he says he's going to do, even though literally everything he can do that he says he's going to do, he fucking does. So they'll learn on their own with that. I had a question about ammo, and this person said they have shotgun ammo and rifle ammo, and they shoot a lot of skeet, and they're not really worried about the ammo they have for skeet because it gets rotated frequently. But some of the other ammo is stored pretty long term, and it gets pretty humid and kind of moist in their area, and they're worried about it. What do they do? Well, first of all, it's not 1900 anymore. And so you're not going to see like your ammo corroding and shit like that from some of the additives to it and whatever. That said, not that long ago, like 10 years ago, you could buy these bandoliers of Turkish 8mm ammo on stripper clips. And these were 8mm ammo for the Turkish Mausers. But they were originally, before the Turks were did what they did with them, they were for machine guns. They were 8mm German guns. It was like World War I first machine guns, World War II type ammo, right? And so it was old as shit. It was stored in these horrible, like, assembly line, cheap-ass, like, stuff that looked like maybe it would be used for bandage wrappings or something, green bandoliers. Some of you have to remember what I'm talking about when I say this. It was everywhere. Cheaper than dirt sold the hell out of them. It was like a bandolier, and I think there were 10, maybe 20. I think it was 20 stripper clips in each bandolier, right? I think it was actually 8 pouches in the bandolier each, so it was 80 rounds for $5. It had corrosive primers. Some of the bullets, when you got it, you could literally like pull the bullet out of the case. That's how old this shit was and how poorly it was taken care of. I had a Turkish Mauser, one of the conversions that, you know, they were in 7 point something. I don't remember. And then the Turkish military sent them to Germany before World War I and had them rebarreled and sent back. You could buy those for like $70 mailed to your house because they were made prior to 1895 or something like that. I had one of those. So I'm like, fuck it. I bought a bunch of this shit. I had no misfires. So the thing to conclude from that is ammo is not as at risk of going bad as we seem to think it is. If you're really worried about it, put in a fucking Ziploc bag. You know, I see people like vacuum sealing their ammo and shit like that. If that makes you happy, fine. But, you know, just a couple of the big 1 gallon Ziploc bags, throw your fucking ammo in there, push the air out and keep it wherever it is. I would be way more concerned about where my ammo is stored relative to something like fire than I would to moisture, unless you're keeping it in the water. But I actually thought maybe that would be an interesting experiment. What I'm thinking about doing is taking like some 357 Magnum or 44 Magnum rounds and put them in like a glass of water and let them sit there for like a week, submerged. Take them out, let them dry out for a week, and go out and fire them and see if there are any misfires or squid fires or something. I bet you there won't be. I bet you they'll just work. I'm not advising you to do that. But, I mean, I have used some old-ass ammo. I had a friend in town one time when I was up in Arkansas. It's when I still lived down here in Texas, but I had my place up in Arkansas before we had moved there semi-permanently for a while. And he had just gotten a new 45-70, and he knew I had one. So when he was coming to see me while we were up there hanging out for a few weeks in the summer, he brought his 45-70. I'm like, yeah, you can shoot it. He brought no ammo. We had to go into town to buy ammo. We paid like $25 for a box of this old friggin' box of ammo. The lead in the bullets was white every round fired. Every round fired. So I am not that concerned about this, but that's what I'd advise you. And, you know, any place you're storing things, there's things that help reduce humidity that you can use. You can buy commercial products if you're really worried about it, do that. But I've never had like a batch of ammo full on go bad because of humidity, temperature, anything. Like, don't be dumb, but I'm just saying, don't overthink it. I've gotten this question a lot over the years. Now, next up, Wired. Wired is losing their effing minds. I mean, they are absolutely going crazy right now over DOGE, which of course is the Department of Government Efficiency, which isn't even a real department. It's just a term that Elon made up on the fly. Yeah, I'm looking at YouTube. I have dog shit video on YouTube too. Why is that the case? I don't know, but it is. I've done everything I can. Anyway, Wired's losing their shit about DOGE. And what they're really losing their shit about, and I honestly think that Elon made sure this was leaked on purpose because the tantrums are just awesome. Apparently, there's six members of DOGE that are really young people. They're like Gen Zers, and they're like Adderall-fueled, semi-autistic Gen Z code bros that are literally like sleeping on site at the DOGE office. And they're just tearing the shit out of everything. On top of this, there are numerous things being released by federal government employees that are using words like "we are terrified" or "this is what fascism looks like." "This is communism" is another one I heard. So let me get this straight. The hallmark of communism, apparently, to these people is reducing the size and power of government equals communism. These are just special people. You really can't help. But the glory of Wired's freaking X feed. You can go look at it now if you're listening to me live. And scroll down to, you'll find this one thread. And it's a thread of threads. It's like they have an article that they wrote and another article they wrote and another article. And it's all about DOGE. And it's all about these Adderall-infused Gen Zoomers, right? They're out there just ripping the shit. And while this is all going on this weekend, Elon kept saying things like, when you work 80 to 120 hours a week and your opponents are people that work 40 hours a week, it's not that hard to win. So like he's taunting these people right now. The other thing that's happened is DOGE has gained access to like the master payment system of the federal government. Now, what people are saying is he's going to spend it on crypto for himself or something stupid like that. Yeah, I don't think Elon Musk wants to spend the rest of his life in federal prison, which is exactly what happened. No, they're not taking the money. They're looking at it and they're going, how much money is being spent on a daily basis? Where's it going? And what are the safeguards against fraud? Turns out there's no safeguards against fraud. None. Now, there's a shitload of things the government does and say they do that I oppose. Okay, and I bet there's a bunch that they have that you oppose to. But what we would at least think would be I don't think this is a reasonable expectation because I don't trust government. But what most people would think as a reasonable expectation is, but the government should be only spending the money on the things the government's supposed to be spending the money on. If they set up a program and they say, like, this organization has to meet these requirements to get this grant or get this money, then they should have to do that. Well, apparently that's not only not the way it works. Like, everybody's comfortable with the fact that it doesn't work that way, and they want it to keep going the way that it's going. They love the grift. And I'm going to tell you that the majority of these bureaucrats that are quitting, getting fired, et cetera, they don't really do much. And what they do is probably things you'd prefer they didn't do. I'm sorry, but it's true. I believe right now – now, look, there are people in the government that do certain things – that even if they could be done by the private sector, they do have some functionality. They do, you know, they sign off on a piece of paperwork that lets oil come in the country. And if they didn't sign that piece of paperwork, the oil wouldn't come in the country. Okay, we probably don't need you for that, but until we replace you with, like, some sort of process that just happens through automation and, like, a checksum on both sides and the computer does it, okay, at least you're doing so. People that unlock a building, you know, people that sweep a floor, like, you would notice if they weren't there. There's a lot of these people, though, that they have very high paying, six-figure income, sometimes multi-six-figure income, over 200 grand. Almost everybody that is like an administrative person that works for the federal government in D.C. that's been there for, you know, let's say 5 years or more is north of 100,000 easy. Plus, they're knocking down health insurance benefits to buy maybe 25,000 a year to buy. If you would even qualify to get them without the federal government behind you. Plus, they get all the holidays. Plus, they get all the federal protections. Plus, they get the PTO. On and on and on it goes. And most of them, like the vast majority of them, have not been to work since COVID started. They work from home remotely. Now, I think working from home remotely is a great thing. But I don't think somebody that has a desk that's being paid for by the federal government in D.C., where that's a very expensive desk to maintain, should not be at their desk, because they went home to work from home 5 fucking years ago like everybody else did because the flu was dangerous or a cold was dangerous. Like, that's all over. Everybody else went back to fucking work. You need to shut the fuck up and go back to work too, especially if your boss says you have to. Now, there's a lot of companies that figured things out during this time. Some of them figured out that our workforce is much happier and most productive if they do not come to work. Now, those companies did something, though, that the ones being raked over the coals or the federal government didn't do. When they sent everybody away, they ran some accountability studies, and they figured out that Bill and Bob and Sam were really important to what the company was doing. And that, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry, like, they really weren't doing anything at all when you, like, because you can, like, literally, like, log people's keystrokes and shit when they're working remotely. And that's not new tech. When I used to work for Fluke Networks as a regional manager up in the Northeast, my counterpart right here in Dallas had a rep firm. It was almost all his territory. It was like half his whole territory was under one rep firm. And he said the guy was a micromanager that ran that rep firm, and he was logging keystrokes. He knew how long they were online, what they were doing, what entries they were making on a, like, he could pull up, you know, at 5 minutes after seven, this is what this person was doing if they were doing anything. So that's the 90s and the early 2000s we're talking about there. So this is not new. So a lot of these companies were running tech like that without their employees knowing it. And guess what? It's totally legal. You're on the clock. I'm paying you with resources I gave you. It's totally legal for me to monitor everything you do and not tell you about it. So these companies went, we'll get rid of Tom, Dick, and Harry. And let's keep Bob, Mike, and Sam or whoever, right? And they got rid of a lot of people, and then they let the productive people stay home. The government didn't do that. And they're shitting their pants. But the biggest thing they're shitting their pants over is this payment system, right? And they got completely rid of USAID, which was a money laundering shithole, by the way. Okay? And more of that's coming. But the word audit is scaring the fuck out of these people. I find this delicious. I'd like to know in live chat, what do you guys think of this? The federal government, whether it's the IRS or many other governmental bodies, love to perform audits on citizens. Did you really go out this many times to eat? How do you justify that, right? Did you really pay for this thing in your business? Was it really necessary? How was it necessary? Like, they love audits. They love to audit shit, and they have all kinds of audits. They have environmental audits. They have building code audit. They have fucking audit after audit. The number one thing bureaucrats that don't work in an office that actually go out in the field do is fucking audit shit. It's not always called an audit. Sometimes it's called an inspection. An inspection is an audit. when they go to a processing facility and say, where's your FDA inspector on site? That's an audit. Right? So the federal government fucking loves to audit the fuck out of citizens. But the federal government, it turns out, is absolutely fucking terrified of citizens auditing the government. Now, I'm going to just throw out an idea here. It is very possible, especially using blockchain technology, and it could be done on the Bitcoin blockchain. It would be the most secure way to do it. But there's other tech that could do it. I'll acknowledge that. It would be very possible to make everything the federal government spends money on, everything the federal government does, instantaneously auditable by anybody in the world while preserving military secrets and things like that, right? You could have certain black holes that, like, this much money went in this hole, and no, we can't tell you exactly what it does because we're building like an eighth generation freaking fighter or something. I don't like that, but I get it. I can understand it. I can see that, how everybody would think that's reasonable. But there's a lot of shit we spend money on. There's no reason for it to be classified, even if it is. And we could, and so my pipe dream for this would be that by the time Elon and his Adderall fueled Zoomers are done, and his they're letting hackers in there. They shouldn't have to let hackers in there. They shouldn't have to let hackers in there. They shouldn't need to hack. When your fucking boss, if you work for the federal government, the president of the United States is, tells you we're doing this, then you're doing this or you're getting fired. Like that one inspector general. He fired all the inspectors generals, and she was like, inspector general of FDA. So I'm not leaving. They can't make me leave. This is illegal. You know what happened? Her ass got perp walked out of her fucking office. Right? Security. Boom. Out she goes. But it would be great if anybody anywhere could just see all the waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying if it's ever going to happen, without the country completely being burned to the ground and being rebuilt from the ashes, if it's ever going to happen without that, it's going to be now or never. It'd be really freaking cool, wouldn't it? It'd be amazed. What I'd be amazed with is when it's all said and done, when the truth really comes out, how many people that are diametrically opposed to this right now would be like, shit, they're doing what? Like, I'm not talking about the wokies and the blue hairs and all that shit. No, I understand there's people you cannot help. These are people that, you know, they write all caps trans rights or human rights and put it 9 times in a row like they're chanting, and then they make a post on X and they think anybody cares. I understand that. I'm talking about, like, the people that crossed the divide and voted for Trump in the last election, and a lot of people that didn't, but they really thought about it. I'm talking about the working class Democrat voter or the potential voter that's working class Democrat. There's a lot of these people, they are just as appalled by this waste, fraud, and abuse as you are. And I'm going to tell you what's happened, and it's a very dangerous place for empire to be, and that's what we are, an empire. When you go to like a dentist or you go to a doctor because you cut yourself, they inject you with Novocaine. Right. And that way they can drill you or stitch up your arm or whatever it is. And you're awake and you're conscious, but you're numb. Right. Novocaine, lidocaine. You have a numbing agent. We have basically accepted for the life of just about every living adult, government is corrupt. And the only thing I can do is side with the corruption that's more in line with what I want than the corruption that's more opposed to what I want. Like, I don't think if you ask the average thinking human being on the street, like a man on the street interview, do you believe the United States government is on the level or corrupt, that very many people are going to say on the level. Further, I believe that you talk to the person who voted D or R 100% of the time for the last 30 years, is only the other side corrupt? They'll say no. Is your side corrupt? Yes. They'll probably say my side's less corrupt, but you say, is it devoid of corruption? Oh, no. So what we have done is we've become numb to corruption. We've become numb to waste. We've become numb to spending money we shouldn't be spending, to the point where we've stopped really paying attention. I would say, since I was a kid, basically people do not pay attention. The shit Rand Paul puts out every year in his Festivus alone should be causing riots in the streets, and everyone's like, oh, that sucks. Anyway, I mean, that's just how people are. if you actually show it and show that it can be stopped or even reined in by, let's say, 50%, it's what we used to call in the military a new minimum standard. So you teach somebody to do something and they do kind of a shitty job, and you know, you keep training them and you keep reinforcing it, especially if it's not like a combat skill or something. Like it's like because they're not infantry, they're mechanic. And you're training somebody, let's say, how to oversee an operator do PMCS maintenance on a 5-ton truck. And they're not really, because they're not comfortable telling this guy that I'll ramp some, hey, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. So you keep training them. And then you go out and you stand back and you watch them do the job you taught them how to do. And they do it perfectly. They man up, they do it. And when you have a conversation with them, first thing you say is, well done. That's exactly the way you're supposed to do your job. And the next thing out of your mouth is, that's a new minimum standard. I expect every interaction that you have with a vehicle's operator to be at least that good from now on, because you've just shown me that you can do it. This is a common thing in what humans expect. If I've seen something done to this level by a person, I expect this person to be able to do this thing at least that well again. That would be glorious. And people say, Jack, you're supposed to be opposed to government. I am. And you give us those two things, the accountability, ability to audit by anybody, and an expectation that something can be done, and we will not burn government to the ground, but we will incinerate it down to about 20 to 25% of what it is right now. And that is a fucking win. That is a win. And, you know, I give the libertarian shit. And when I say libertarians, I'm talking here, I'm talking about capital L Libertarian Party, right? So the small L libertarians, I give shit that are the voters. But then the small L libertarians that are really anarchists, if you think I'm letting you out, I'm not. You can be special too. You can be full retard too. And I'm telling you, if you wouldn't make the deal to cut the government from 100% to 25%, you're just as fucked up in the head as the people that say they wouldn't make the deal to make the government zero. But we'll grow back. Yeah, but I'm going to, you know, like the analogy always says, well, that's like telling a doctor you want them to take out only 75% of the tumor. Sometimes the doctor can only get to 75% of the tumor. That's just reality. Getting to 25% the size of current government would be amazing. It would be absolutely amazing. There's an argument about the civilized society thing, but I think the argument is actually two people that agree. Next thing, though, I had a question on biochar in wicking beds. And what this person said is, can you put biochar in a wicking bed as a wicking agent? And they asked two ways they can do it. One, when you build a wicking bed, you have some way you're feeding water in and some form of overflow. And you have kind of an empty space in the bottom. And that empty space can be made up with sand, gravel, lava rock, pipes. And then you have kind of a layer. Usually I do two layers of weed blocker. And then on top of that, I do a layer of perlite. And then I do my soil mix from there. And that does a really good job of pulling moisture up into the bed so that as long as there's water in the reservoir, you never have to water. And the beauty of this, when you combine it into an aquatic or aquaponic system, is since the water's not flowing through the grow medium, the soil, you can use all of the fertility aids you want. If your plant's a little low in nitrogen, you just throw some blood meal at it. If it's a little low in your three primary nutrients, your NPK, you throw some organic fertilizer on it. If it's a particular nutrient, you can do that. And you can even use some forms of pest control that are not highly toxic, because I don't recommend that, but some things that if you got it in your water, that would be bad. That's one of the beautiful things about it. And there's two ways we do this. We either do this with a static wicking bed, which basically means there's some sort of float valve or just a daily requirement that it be filled up. And if it rains, it overflows to basically nowhere. And then what we call a flow through, and that's where we have a water reservoir. We have a pump that's either on a timer or runs constantly. Water comes in, keeps us at our level, overflows back into the reservoir. All of that works. You absolutely can fill up the bottom of your reservoir with charcoal, biochar. There's no reason you can't do that. It will not hurt a thing, sort of, depending on what you're doing with the whole system. And it certainly won't hurt anything long term. But it's expensive. whether you make it yourself or buy it from someone, there's a lot of labor that goes into making really high quality biochar. There's getting your material, sizing your material, doing your kiln burn, quenching, crushing, etc. Okay? It doesn't do any good sitting in the reservoir, because you don't need the reservoir itself to be a very wicky material. I use lava rock. It's porous. It has a lot of place for microorganisms and all. And yes, some charcoal down there would be nice, but it's unnecessary. And it's not where it would be most beneficial. So to me, this is a highly valuable commodity. Now, if you're sitting on an absolute assload surplus of charcoal and you want to put it down there, go ahead. To me, I would use a more standard fill in your bottom, and then I would mix my biochar at about 10% into the soil mix profile, because it's outstanding at water absorption and wicking. So I would use the biochar in the soil profile, where it will now hold on to microorganisms, hold on to nutrients, and interact with the plants. Because if there's plant roots down in your reservoir, you fuck something up. You don't want your roots getting down there. When they get down there, shit gets clogged up. This is especially true, though, if you're doing a flow-through wicking bed, where you have a reservoir of, like, fish in it or something like that, that you might be doing other aquaponics things like ebb and flow with. Here's what's going to happen if you fill that waste space in a flow-through bed in that model with biochar. For a few weeks, it is going to literally grab onto all the nutrient load that comes through it from your fish waste and things like that. It's not necessarily bad, because you'll have very clean water. The problem is, if you're trying to grow anything with that water in things other than wicking beds where you can directly provide fertility, you're going to have low fertility. All of that nitrite that's going to nitrate, that's feeding your plants and all that good stuff, the biochar is going to have it. If you're thinking, I don't care, I want fish, and I'm not really growing with the water, I'm doing flow through wicking beds, and by doing this, I'm going to have this great filter system. Yeah, for a few weeks. If you're lucky and your nutrient load is low at the time, a few months. But once that charcoal's full, it's not going to take any more. And it's not going to be any more of a filter than inert material at that point, if that makes sense. Like, you could have like a bunch of pieces of PVC in there or some shit, or bio balls or ceramics or anything in there. You're going to get the same effect that the charcoal is going to give you in that application. If you want to use charcoal to filter water, then you need to have, like, you need to figure out, like, watch your levels and how long does this charcoal remain highly effective and when does it stop. And then you need a maintenance schedule that says if it's 2 weeks, at 12 days, the charcoal gets replaced. And then you take that high charge charcoal and use it somewhere else in some other system. Now, again, there are people out there maybe that are making shit tons of biochar. And my comment that it's expensive, are like, I'll screw that. And specifically what you might do is when you're doing your crushing, you have some of that material that doesn't want to crush, right? If you keep going and keep recrushing it, eventually you'll get it to nice, small, fine for soil use. But like, you want to move fast and you're making a lot, you do one or two crushings and you have that stuff that's all like, you know, the size of like buckwheat coal or something like that. Throw that in there. I get it, because for you, it's probably cheaper than buying bags of something like lava rock. There's just one thing to know about biochar in a system like that. From what I've heard from Stephen Reisner using it in ebb and flow, over time it breaks down. It goes to a slurry and it will flow through the whole system. It's not necessarily bad in of itself on its effect on the system, but within a water reservoir where it's able to flow out, eventually you're going to have dead space down there. It's going to collapse. And that's why I like a permanent component into the reservoir. And I don't consider charcoal permanent in that application. If it breaks down in your soil, it becomes part of the soil profile in smaller and smaller particles. If it breaks down in flowing water, it flows wherever the water goes. Next, I want to talk about tariffing a little bit. I told you we're all over the map today. So tariff. Well, tariffs, and is there going to be able to afford avocados? That's what is his name, Chuck Schumer, right? Is there a more out-of-touch moron in our government than Chuck Schumer? I think AOC is smarter than Chucky Schumer. AOC is dumb as a fence post. Chuck Schumer is a fence post that got hit by a fucking truck. I mean, just useless. This is a guy that did a photo op, and not only is he an idiot, his people are idiots. Remember he put the cheap-ass generic cheese on a burger patty on his grill to melt the cheese? That doesn't sound bad. He did this thing about, I never cooked on a grill before. Yeah, we can't tell, Chuck. The problem was the fucking meat was raw. So he has this great picture out right now that he's about as proud of as he was of his grill. He's holding up an avocado and a bottle of Corona. You're not going to be able to afford Valentine's because you're not going to be able to afford avocados and Corona. You're not going to be able to afford a Super Bowl party because you can't afford avocados and Corona. Shut up. This is dumb. This is dumb. This is dumb. This is dumb. And it's dumber than a box of rocks. Dumb. First of all, Mexico, between the time I wrote this bullet and I went live, caved. The president of Mexico called Trump and said, we were kidding. We all want to do this. We want a month to figure out your other issues. But they're going to deploy, I think it's like 10,000 Mexican troops to control their own border. This happened in a weekend. So, Colombia, we're not doing shit. Fucking 1 hour. Okay, we'll do it. We'll take our people back. Not Ecuador? Damn it. Chavez. Who's Chavez in charge of? He caved. Why is that not coming to me right now? It's just gone from my brain, right? Venezuela. Venezuela caved. They're like, we'll do whatever we got to do. Now Mexico caved, right? Mexico caved in a weekend. Venezuela caved in a week. Freaking Colombia caved in an hour. So my question is, how Maduro, that's what it is. It's Maduro. Who the fuck is Chavez? What am I talking about there? I don't know. It's a Monday. Anyway, yes, I'm talking about Venezuela and Maduro, right? So he caved. I wonder how long it's going to take maple syrup Castro, right? Trudeau to cave in Canada. And what I got back from people on X today when I said that he would cave is, oh, no, they won't. It doesn't matter. The people of Canada will never put pressure on him. They have Stockholm syndrome. Like, his approval rating is like 23%, but I think he was like 77% of the vote, his party was, for PM last election. Like, that's how unbalanced it is. But that's not the problem for Trudeau or the Canadian government right now. We'd like to believe that other governments are different, like, if nothing else, to make us feel that ours isn't as bad as theirs. But the real cancer, the real Chavez was the old Venezuela. That's why it's in my head. But anyway, the real cancer in all government is oligarchy, more so than anything else is oligarchy. And that is the elites that are able to leverage the government into policies that benefit the elites, even if they're not directly involved in government. Okay. These are the people that can make a phone call and talk to, in the United States, a senator or even a president, and certainly a cabinet member or the top bureaucrat in a department. They can make a phone call, and if that person's not available, their PA will make sure they're called back. Canada has those people too. Canada has an elite class. Every freaking nation has a class of elites, parasites, that suck from the country's wealth. North Korea has an elite class, a parasitic class. A lot of what Little Rocket Man has to do, he has to do to keep his elites happy, lest he end up dead. Right? So he has to not end up dead. People like Trudeau have to end up not sent packing. And I'm going to tell you right now, the people who will hurt the most in Canada because of these tariffs are the elites. They're the ones that own the companies that sell all this shit to America. They're the ones that own the companies that import all the shit from America and sell it into Canada. And Canada has taxed the United States through tariffs out the ass over the years. Some of the tariffs on some U.S. goods are 100, 200%. Average is about between 25 and 45% of all U.S. goods that go to Canada are tariffed. That way, right now, there is nothing new about Canada putting tariffs on American goods. But there is a stasis that's reached when tariffs are in place long enough where people just kind of naturally now accept it. Like, this is what this product costs. Either they don't buy imported good anymore, or the imported good is so necessary to that country, they accept it. And the elite profit off this. They're the ones that own the corporations. Well, they are not going to be happy at all. Somebody doesn't understand maple syrup Castro, because they're saying Castro is a student of the WEF cabal. Maybe you do. Maybe you're talking about Trudeau. I'm calling him maple syrup Castro less because of what he does, but more because of his mom's past. To be clear on that. Anyway, there is no leverage that Canada or Mexico have in a tariff war against the United States in the end. We are way more important to their GDP than they are to ours. You want to see, like, with Mexico? Again, they already caved. You know why? Because freaking Orange Man could go scorched earth on Mexico tomorrow. Because this is another thing that can be done with an emergency EO. He could just simply say, it is illegal to make remittances from the United States back to Mexico unless you have a bank account and you're doing it through approved channels. In other words, no Western Union. Yeah, I know they can do it with Bitcoin, Litecoin, whatever, but they're not. That demographic is not really worked out how to use that yet. They don't have time. If you cut off remittances to Mexico, which could be done again with a pen stroke, I'm not saying it should be. I'm saying it could be. Right, there's real world here. That's what I'm talking about. It's not what I would do. I'm weather forecasting. With a stroke of a pen, 60 days, you could break Mexico's back economically. That's just one. And cut off all the foreign aid on top of it at the same time. And then say, you didn't like my 25% tariff? Now it's fucking 50. Right? And I know you're like, that's psychotic. You elected a psycho. Freaking Trump is, in many ways, good for this country, but he acts like a psychopath. If I say I'll do it, I'll do it. And if you call me on it, I'll double do it just to prove to you I wasn't lying so you'll believe me next time. Again, read The Art of the Deal, right? Read The Art of the Deal, man. This is straight out of Trump's book. By the way, it's about the only book he actually wrote. He still had a ghostwriter write it, but he dictated it. Most of his other books, all he did was go, yeah, I like the syllabus and the outline on this rubber stamp. It was all ghostwritten. Art of the Deal was long before Trump was as big as he is when he first let that out, and that is his playbook for making deals. I'm telling you, he'll do it. Upshot is, I don't care about this. And I don't not care because I have no ethical concerns. That's not what I mean. I mean that I am a sane human being, and that I know that me ranting and raving on social media or telling you this is bad or whatever will not affect the policy at all. So all I do when it comes to policy is make you informed, tell you what it means, and say this is what you need to do to prepare for it. If you are an American, unless you are running a supply chain that deeply depends on Corona beer and avocados or Canadian sour crude oil, which is not as important as you think it is, I'll explain that in a second, what you need to do about this is go on with your life and not worry about it. If you want to write your congressman or senator or Trump or freaking J.D. Vance or Snuffleupagus Monster or whatever, go ahead. But it's not going to change anything. And this is not really going to affect your life. And if you're that worried about the cost of your avocado toast at Starbucks, get a fucking toaster and learn to mash a fruit. And shut up already. I'm sorry. This is not a major life-changing thing for you, no matter how much Chuckie Schumer says it is. As far as the sour crude from Canada, this is what you need to understand. The reason we buy Canadian sour crude at a discount is because we're the only country that can buy it at that price, get it to a refinery, and deal with their shitty quality crude. It is the shittiest of shitty oil of shitty oils. It's bad. It is nothing like some of the top-end crude to come out of Texas. Now, there's a lot of sour crude that comes out of like the Texas Permian Basin and stuff too. But we have some really high-end crude oil in the United States. Canada is almost all sour crude. It is hard to refine, and the Canadians cannot refine it. There isn't a refinery in Canada that can turn that shitty-ass oil into the products that oil makes, like gasoline or diesel. They do not have the refining capacity at all. They got zero. If they had 50% of the refining capacity of production capacity, they'd still be fucked, and they have none. So it ends up in places like freaking Texas and Louisiana being refined. But here's the other side of it. The United States imports like 80% of its oil from Canadian side. And you know what we do with it? We refine it and we sell it to fucking other people outside of our country. There's no way around this. This is all factual. You can fact check me if you don't believe me, and please do. I always say you should doubt everybody, even me. Fact check anything you want to. But I'm telling you right now, there is no way. Scott King says, comment. I'm going to handle this one right now. The Art of the Deal was ghostwritten through observing Trump and how he negotiated and documenting the process and mindset. It was not ghostwritten. I can tell you for a fact, I've explained in the past why I know it wasn't it was not ghostwritten. It was ghost inscribed, right? Somebody actually put the words down. That is Trump's playbook. And if you don't think he's following it, I don't think you read it. Or if you read it, you need to read it again because you read it a long time ago and you forgot some things, right? And you're missing the whole part of things are not revealed until you need to reveal them inside the Art of the Deal. So some of the things that are going on, you're not seeing because you don't need to see them. This is textbook Trump. This is not rah-rah Trump. This is a statement of fact. Anyway, it's not going to affect you. You shouldn't care. Most of the Canadian oil that comes to the United States, there's no other buyer for it. They're going to sell it to China. Go ahead. So China needs to build like five giant fucking refineries they don't have, even in China. That takes a fucking while. Now you got to ship it on a fucking tanker to China, and then it's got to be shipped somewhere else. And then you got to get them, under that situation, to pay you at least as much as the United States. See where this problem just starts to unravel? Maple syrup Castro is going to cave. He will probably be a little bit more cross-leg classy about how he caves and try to make it look a little bit like more like he got a win. So he can say, look what I did. I stood up to Orange Man. No one will believe it. But I'm telling you, it doesn't have 2 months in it. It doesn't have 2 months in it. If it has 2 months, I'll be surprised. But there's no way this goes beyond 60 days before he starts getting the shit beat out of him by his own elite class. Hey, man, you're fucking up our shit. We're not making the money we're supposed to make, man. You want our backing. That's how this game is played. That's the other side of the Art of the Deal. All these politicians have somebody pulling their strings on the other side with their money. All of them. Now, what I want to end with is monetary policy a little bit. And I want to recommend a book to you. It is called Broken Money, and it's written by Lynn Alden, L-Y-N-A-L-D-E-N, Lynn Alden. I'm listening to the audio right now, and it just so happens that this topic that I listened to a couple chapters of today while I was taking care of the ducks fit perfectly with all of the money topics of today. And they are particularly, I believe they are section 1, chapter 9, 10, 11, somewhere in that range. I could probably actually look it up. Hopefully it won't start playing on me. It would be chapters 10, the Bretton Woods system, chapter 11, the rise of the petrodollar, and chapter 12, pushing chaos to the periphery. Those are the three chapters that I'm drawing from today. And now it's playing. Of course it is. All right. Anyway, you know, I knew a lot about the Bretton Woods system, and I don't think there was anything in those three chapters that I didn't know. But having them all drop together made me sit back and really think about how fucking evil the United States is, our European and British allies are, the IMF and the World Bank are, and what's really going on, and this new neocolonialism, which is redundant because neo means new. So this neocolonialism that's going on today is, in some ways, it is far worse than classic colonialism. I'm going to say that classic colonialism, as much as it did bad, it kind of did an equal amount of good, in that colonialists came in and ran the country and employed the people that worked there. Again, I'm not saying this is good. I'm just saying it's less bad than what we're doing today. And in doing so, the colonialists became responsible for all the infrastructure, building it, maintaining it, taking care of it, etc. They became responsible to make sure the farms produced, even if they were doing it in very hard-handed ways. If it didn't produce, it was their problem. They were living there too. They were co-inhabiting the space. Neocolonialism is far more extractive. So classic colonialism, sure, they were taking a lot of raw material and shipping it back to the mothership, but they were also living there and having to deal with it and be responsible for it. And that meant the colonizer had to pay for almost everything. Neocolonialism says, well, we'll pay for it, but we'll loan it to you. And once we got through Bretton Woods, once we got to the point where the U.S. dollar became the backing currency for the world, and then we were able to pull off and fucking get away with decoupling from gold in 71 under Nixon, temporarily, it's still here, so it's not very temporary, is it? We ended up in a really interesting place. First of all, if you are the United States, the British government, the European government, and governments we're very friendly with advanced economies like Japan and a few other players in the game, you have a lot of sovereignty over your currency, even with the U.S. being top dog. In other words, the EU can inflate and deflate the euro at will and maintain a lot of control over their currency. Even if they don't do a great job, what they do, a person living in Lebanon would cream their jeans for their currency to be that stable. We can do it because we are the masters in the game. So we have this sovereignty that we can use to inflate and deflate our currency at will because we are the peg. We are the peg that everything else adjusts to. So that alone puts developing nations and any nation that's not in our good graces at an inherent disadvantage, especially if they're not large and well-developed yet. Because when their currency starts to have a problem, they really can't rein in inflation. They can't quantitatively ease their way out of a problem like we did a few years ago, and they can't tighten and pull it back in the way we do. So that alone allows their monetary instrument to be stripped. And the people that are harmed the most as monetary instruments are stripped are the ones that have to work for and pay for everything in that instrument. Meaning if you're an elitist and you live in Egypt, you're not holding Egyptian fucking money. You're holding U.S. fucking dollars. But if you're a common slob in Egypt that, like, changes oil, you're earning Egyptian currency, you're saving in Egyptian currency, you're paying your bills in Egyptian currency. And so when there's an 18% inflation, you just had your wages cut by 18% that quarter or year. Make sense? So this is already inherently evil, the way that system was designed. Because now we can say, well, you know, you don't do what we want, maybe we don't help prop up that little problem you got going on right there. And since we have all the money, we can do things like, you know, maybe we pull our military base out and all the jobs go along with it, leave you vulnerable to your enemies that are just across the border from you. Right? All that's evil, but it's way worse. None of that is really neocolonialism. That's just the monetary policy as a whole. Now we're going to see how the monetary policy becomes the method of neocolonialism. So that's an interesting natural resource you found there. Look at that. You have a whole shitload of oil under your surface. Too bad you don't have the technology and the money to extract it. Oh, look, you guys are a great country to grow tea or coffee or cocoa. Some really expensive luxury good that most of the people that live where you are can't afford to buy. But if you grow it, you can sell it to all the rich people that live in America and France. Yeah? Okay. So, but how are you going to get it done? I got an idea. We'll loan you the money. We'll just loan you the money. Interest rate's not even that bad. It's not even that bad. Oh, wait a minute. Son of a bitch. You guys don't have any petroleum engineers. You don't have any petroleum engineers. You have like one, and he studied in Texas, and he went back home, but he doesn't have a team. You need to hire American or European companies to come in and build your extraction infrastructure. Oh, you also don't have any ability to like refine that oil or package that cocoa or process it. So we have people that can do that too. So we'll loan you the money. You hire us. Our company goes into your country. develops all this shit for you. But son of a bitch, you know, we just can't develop it in a way that we can hand it off to you. We have to stay there. We have to stay there with our money and our corporations. We're not really living among you, mind you, now. In fact, much of the shit labor will be done by your people. But none of your people will ever quite be up to the point where they can actually run things, because son of a bitch, we're going to make sure that's the case. So the company, the American company, the European company, the British company, the Japanese company, the Chinese company comes in, and they extract the money back that was loaned to you, and you have to pay interest on it for infrastructure that you can only maintain by maintaining the relationship with the outside expertise and management to extract that resource. Now, if you're a colonialist, this is a much better deal. This is very akin to the transformation of slavery. You see, when there were slaves in the United States, like when it was legal, I'm talking about, prior to the war between the states, aka the Civil War, the U.S. Civil War, there was no income tax. There was a very brief income tax by the Union during the Civil War, and it was very inexpensive, and it only applied to really rich people, and it went away. It was actually a temporary government program, son of a bitch. Kind of went away, came with and went away with the greenback. And it wasn't until 1913 that we really had an income tax, and even then it took another 10, 15 years before the average person paid it. Somehow we survived that whole swath of 1776 up to 1913 and beyond with no real income tax. But we had slave labor. And when you had slaves, you had to give them a house. You had to give them clothes. You had to give them some money. You had to feed them. They got sick. You had to take care of them. When they got old, they were your problem. Believe it or not, there was actually some things in place that made that true. And so you were responsible for the health and the safety and the sustenance of your slave. And then when that all went away, it took half a century, but eventually, like, we want our slaves back. Somebody got the idea, you know, if we tax a portion of their income, they're partial slaves. And I'm sure there's some people, like, around these, you know, bigwig meetings, partial slaves. I mean, what good's a partial slave? But what if everybody was your slave? So instead of having 10% of the population be slaves at 100%, what if like 90% of your population were slaves at like 25%? And here's the good part. You don't have to house them. You don't have to feed them. You don't have to take care of them. They will go out and work. They'll earn their own income, and we'll just take some of it. And we'll do it in when they buy a house, we'll tax that. When they have an income, we'll tax that. When somebody dies and leaves their money to the next person, we'll tax that. When they spend their money, we'll tax that. Well, when will we tax them? Well, once they're dead and we tax what they leave behind, then they're free and clear, just like a slave. Let me ask you the question. Would you rather have 10% of the population of slaves you're responsible for, or have 90% of a population be slaves to you, be responsible for themselves, but they're fractional slaves at 25 to 30%? Which one is better for you? Which one makes you more money and makes you do less work? That's exactly what happened. We are all now, on some levels, fractional slaves to our federal, state, and local governance. We are. If somebody has a claim on your property or your labor, then you, that portion of your efforts are owned by, and that portion of your property are owned by them. And this is why some people shit their pants about these tariffs. I don't like tariffs. My tariff policy as president would be very simple. I will tariff you at 2X on all your goods, whatever good you tax the highest from my country into yours. If you, the highest tax you have is on, let's say, American cars and it's 5%, then there's a flat tax of 10% on every fucking thing you bring into America. And it's a hard rule, 2X. Highest number. What's zero times two? I don't care what Terrence Howard says. Zero times two is zero. You don't want to pay a tariff? Well, then don't tariff our shit. Very simple. And we're a big enough bully, and I would be using the power of being a bully, I think eventually for good, to do that. But we'll tariff you at 100%. Okay, 200%. The fucking math's easy. Doubling shit's fucking simple. By the way, we won't even have half percentages. We're just going to round up. You know, If doubling it would be 175.5, it's just going to be 176. Fuck that. We'll just round it up to 180. We'll round it to the nearest 10. How about that? Up to the nearest 10. We'll do that. 2x, round it up to the nearest 10. I'm sure everybody would hate it until, well, how does this work? Okay, you stop tariffing our shit, and we don't tariff your shit. And we're probably the only country that could get away with that. The EU might be able to pull that off, but I don't really think they could. I don't think China could. If anybody else could do it, it'd be between EU and China. Japan couldn't fucking do that. Tell me another country that could have that policy and it would work for them. It would swing the entire globe in a single annual cycle. There'd be the only countries that wouldn't do it would be ones that already don't sell much to us and don't get much from us. There's a few. And we don't care about them because they're not enough to even be a full percentile in the deal. That's how. But if we would say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a flat tariff on every fucking thing that comes into the United States of, let's say, 10%, even 15%. That would be pretty high, by the way, for some things. It would be low for other things, just so you know. 15% flat tariff. Any product made not in America that comes into America has a flat tariff of 15%. But here's the trade-off. No income tax. And the only way I would trust it, you'd have to be a literal freaking constitutional amendment outlawing individual income tax. I already think it's unconstitutional, but clearly that doesn't work. We need one that says it is hereby abolished in the United States of America that individual income be taxed. That's how simple the amendment would be. In any way, shape, or form, you can't tax it. Okay? Can't tax income. But you could tax it. I would take that deal that fast. First of all, the amount of work I do every year to avoid these fucking parasites stealing my money would go down to almost nothing. That would be the first thing. And secondly, I choose what I buy. I choose what I buy. And when I buy something, I pay tax on it one time. And what does this incentivize me to do? Number one, buy American. Number two, if I'm not buying American, to buy the best thing I can get for my money. We are a junk consumer economy. We buy fucking garbage. The average American buys the cheapest fucking thing they can get. This is why I'm so big on price to value ratio. I already think it's a bad idea. But the incentive is there for you to do it. And humans are consistent that they follow incentives. And the incentives that we have in this world right now, mainly due to the monetary policy I was talking about, are perverse. And that means that people literally spend less money right now in order to spend more money long term. They buy a thing that they know will break, but I'm going to get a raise and there's going to be inflation and it doesn't matter anyway. And I might as right now, this does what I need for a time and I'll just replace it later. That is a sick society. You want to know why we're physically sick? Because we're mentally sick. We think that way. I remember my grandparents, their attitude about buying something. Can you get a better one? Well, yeah, but it costs more. But do you have the money? Is this something you're going to use for years? If you're not going to use it for years, I mean, if you're going to eat it or drink it, okay, I get it, right? But if you're not going to, if it's something you're buying, if it's a physical good, if it's a product that you're going to have around for a while, if you're not going to have it for 5 years, why are you buying it? That was their first, and as a kid, you're like, what the fuck? I just want a toy, right? Like, I get it, you know? But like, they had a point. And then it was like, so if it costs you $25 more, which in the 1980s was, you know, $25, there was a lot of people that worked, you know, half a day to make $25, by adults back then, right? So $25 was a significant differential in price. If it was, especially if somebody's $100 versus $125, that hurt to go up that. But he's like, they were like, you know, if you're going to use it for 5 years, then shouldn't you buy some of the last 10 or more? Can you get a better product for a little bit more money? And 25%, that was a little bit more money in their mindset because they were not thinking about tomorrow. They were thinking about 5, 10, 20 years out. And then all you had to do to understand this, and I did as a kid because I was a kid that loved going through shit, finding shit, digging through shit, going to my grandpa's workshop, start pulling shit out. I'm like, what the fuck is this thing? Oh, that's sharp. It cut me. Shit. Grandpa, what is this? Oh, it's a plane. You know, you're a little kid. You're like, a plane? It doesn't have any wings. No, no, no. It's a plane. It's for plane of wood. And show me how it works. And I'll be like, what? That's cool. And he'd tell me, you know, you should true up the edge or to take this off or whatever. And you're like, ah, that's really awesome. Like, where'd you get this? That was my dad's. That's my dad's. And it still worked. Literal fucking, I found rat traps that were from the Great Depression era that still worked in the mid-80s. All you had to do was look at the things, if they weren't hoarders anyway, look at the things that they bought in their life and kept. And then you can now look back at that and understand something. That stuff was built and that stuff was bought. And that stuff was cared for in a world of hard money. That's why it's like that. We are at a peak fiat world because we are at a peak fiat economy. You could not have, like, I know it looks a lot nicer the way we decorate shit and it's all automated. Like, open the door and the door opens by itself. You got a ring doorbell and all this automation in our homes. It seems like the Jetsons or whatever. It's like the Joe Spoodies, though, if you know who Joe Spoodie was, right? The Joe Spoodies. Everything is cheap. Everything's Wile E. Coyote, Acme fucking catalog. Why do you think that old cartoon made fun of Acme? Right? He always bought cheap shit. It always blew up in his face. What do you think it was just to make kids laugh? Or do you think that, you know, like The Simpsons, you can watch The Simpsons with a kid. And the kid laughs at a bunch of shit you laugh at too. And then you laugh at things the kid doesn't get. What do you think the fucking Acme catalog that always blew up in the coyote's face was actually for? You like to see poof, right? That's what you like to see. But your granddad was like, ah, he's going to buy the cheap shit. It's going to blow up in his face. Peak fiat. See, they lived in a world where we really didn't know what fiat money was. No one had ever really used fiat money. Even up into 71, there was at least the belief, and the belief is part of the incentive. So the psychology of the spender up into 1971 was the dollar is gold. And I'm going to tell you, 20 years later, 1991, there were still people that didn't really know that the dollar wasn't really redeemable for gold anymore. They didn't know the Federal Reserve was a private entity. I remember my teacher telling us this in high school. In the 80s, but about 86, 87, Dr. Larson, I remember him saying, like, he brought the phone book in. And he said, if you look in the phone book, there's white pages. That's all of you. That's you and me. We're all in there if your phone number's listed. There's yellow pages. Those are all the businesses. And there's the blue pages. They're all the government. This is a good teacher, right? He probably would get fired today. He hands the book to one of the kids in the class. He says, I want you to look up the Federal Reserve. In the phone book. So the kids in the yellow pages, F, federal, you know, or in the blue pages for government, federal, a few things. There's no Federal Reserve. Was in the yellow pages. He's like, what did I just tell you about the yellow pages? The Federal Reserve was listed in the yellow pages as a business, the local branch, Philadelphia branch of the Federal Reserve in high school. And all the kids were like, because we all grew up listening to Silent Generation and GI Generation grandparents, right? Boomer parents, GI, and Silent grandparents. And we were always told about the value of money and saving your money. It's better off in a box under a mattress than it is in the bank. They had lived through the bank runs. They lived through it all. And you're like, fuck, they're wrong. They're not wrong, but they're wrong. This is the world you live in today. This is why I bookended this show, ending here and starting with Bitcoin. You can be like our friend, Eugene Fama, who says it's going to go to zero in 10 years. And by the way, this guy is, I'm not picking on old people here, but this dude is old enough, he won't be here to see himself be wrong. And he knows that. That's a very safe prediction. To make a prediction, you know you'll die before it happens. This guy has to be 93, 94 years old. I could be wrong about that, but I'm just looking at the picture. Right. Let me look that up while we're talking here so I can get that right. Maybe he could still be around. Maybe we could. Who's going to bother you, though? Age. Let's see that. He's 85. The odds that he'll be here at 95 are, you know, it's not impossible, but it's not good. He's probably not going to be around. And like I said, who bothers a 95-year-old guy, right? But he's a Nobel laureate. But I want to read to you again. I really do. I want to read to you what he actually said. He didn't actually claim it was going to go to zero. He wished for it to go to zero, and he said the following. The persistence of Bitcoin poses a challenge to established economic principles. I'm hoping it will bust. I'm hoping does not sound like a prediction to me, Fama said, because if it doesn't, you have to start all over with monetary theory. Okay, modern monetary theory has already been proven to be a cancer. You already have to start over. There is no way around this. I'm sorry, there isn't. There just isn't. All you have to do is look at everything in this country and the world that is bad. Everything that causes us problems, cancer rates, obesity rates, diabetes rates, autism rates, right? Causation doesn't equal correlation, I get, except when it's everything is correlated. When everything is correlated to one thing, the number of administrators versus teachers in schools, the number of administrators versus doctors and nurses in medicine, the number of regulators versus the number of people being regulated, the total number of regulations. There is one inflection point in history, one, where all these things go to shit. They all go parabolic. Inflation rate goes parabolic, which is the devaluation of money going parabolic. The cost of entry into homeownership goes parabolic. The cost of education in college level goes parabolic. And it never stops. Once it starts up, it stays at that same inclination rate constantly. And that one inflection point, I defy anybody to prove this wrong. I'll debate anybody on this subject. Unprepared, no notes. You can do anything you want. You can have an assistant if you want to debate this. It's 1971 is the singular inflection point where all of this went. Farms exploded in size and farm ownership was diluted in the number of people that own farms. The chemicals in our food exploded. The additives in our food exploded. The nutritive quality of the food we're growing went down. They all have one inflection point, one genesis moment. And it was the dissolution of the last vestiges of money having any control on its production. The production of any good, and money is a monetary good. It is a product like any other product. I'm sorry if you don't believe it. Should be directly correlated to its utility. In other words, the more valuable it is to people and the more demand there is for it, the more of it there should be, and the supply will naturally balance against demand over time. There could be a supply excess or shortage, but sooner or later the market will correct it. Money is no different. That's always how, when there was really a need for more money, then people said, hey, let's add silver. Let's make smaller denominations. Right? Let's make a fucking, like, the bank note system against gold to make it more divisible. If gold's worth $300, how do you spend a dollar of it? Like, if the system was honest, that actually worked. Of course, nobody can be trusted with the power to print money. They will always give in to the lure of that power. But functionally, it can work. The minute you decouple that, the minute you say to loan more money, all you have to do is borrow more money and we'll give you as much money as you ask for, it's over. Now everybody's wish list can be fulfilled in a world of non-reality. This is why they thought they could fix supply chain problems by printing money during COVID. Because everybody believes money is the answer. If we just give this country money, they'll evolve. No, they won't. If they don't have natural resources and they have to bring them in, they won't evolve. They'll become dependent on where they come from. If you don't teach them to develop what they have to provide most of their needs so they only import what they have to, they will never evolve. If you go develop their systems for them and they don't develop them themselves and they don't develop the time, they don't put the time in to develop the talent, the technology, and know how to run it, prepare it, and evolve it and make it better, then they're dependent on you forever. That's neocolonialism. That's where we are. So you don't have a lot of options. Your money is Bitcoin, whether you accept it or not, and the sooner you accept it, the better off you will be. Your food should come from places you know as much as possible. Your coffee is still going to come from South America or Africa or Central America. So is your chocolate. That's fine. But in general, like, your beef should come from America. And if it can, it should come from your state. And if it can, it should come from your county. You should grow your own food. You should do what I'm saying these smaller governments should do, develop what you have where you are. But you have to stop the financial bleed. As long as you work for a living, you're earning the king's fiat. And the king will steal from your fiat because that's the last task, the last tax. The tax on your income is evil. The tax on your property is satanic. To repeatedly charge a tax on something I bought 20 years ago, that's satanic level evil. The tax on everything you do is evil. But the tax on the money you hold, do you understand that there's a tax on the money you hold? If you have $100,000 in the bank right now, you probably feel pretty good about that. But there's a tax on it. It's called inflation. And that means if inflation this year is 3%, that tax is $3,000 this year. But when it's 3% next year, it's $3,000 next year. And it's always a multiple of what you're holding while the value of the multiple goes down. And where did it run away? Everybody likes to look at the graph from 1913 to present and see the devaluation of the dollar. But check out where the inflection point is. If you look at a map of inflation from 1913 to 1970, it doesn't look great. But if you look at one from 1913 to 2025, that whole period from 1913 to 1969, 1970, looks almost flat. That's how big the inflection point is. You do you, guys. I'm just telling you what we could do. Man, we went long. Let's go ahead and hit some like lightning round this stuff. Anarchy with a $7.77 super chat. Thank you, sir. He said, getting the party started right. I thank you for that. No question. Divine Fungi says, Jack, here's your thoughts on Trump just signed EO for a sovereign wealth fund, the possible vector for Bitcoin without legislation. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I can't comment on it. I'd have to look at it. But a sovereign wealth fund probably can't equal a Bitcoin reserve the way that it's been talked about. But I'll have to look at it. I just don't know yet. That had to happen today. So I'll have to read it and see what it says and start picking it apart and do some analysis of it. Builder Castle says, with the fiat shenanigans going on, I can see suppliers like Latex from Africa being sold for Bitcoin, and then Bitcoin will be one step toward Bitcoin economy. Could you see that happen? No. No. I don't know why this is hard to understand, guys. If you are working inside a supply chain and you have that supplier has to have materials to do their job and they have to make payroll. There is no case for taking your cash flow into a volatile asset. It isn't going to happen. Now, I could see that exporter saying, let's ruthlessly manage our fiat cash flow and sweep profits that are retained into Bitcoin. That's the model. Michael Saylor has demonstrated that model. You don't even have to like them. The model works. The model works because it's done with capital that the business is not dependent upon. And you've got to understand that when a company is doing business day, the vast majority of the sale is cash flow that the company will be dependent upon in the short term. I don't care how profitable they are. All those billions add up over months and months and years. That's how that works. And those companies are not that profitable. They're not so. See, tech companies are ideal to do this with because they have a high margin. When you're dealing in a physical good, you buy the very nature of a physical good. Unless you're the only one producing it, are going to have a low margin. If anybody can compete with you, you're going to have a low margin. These are economic laws, not economic opinions, guys. I'm sorry. Nick says, have you read all of Software? In a future live stream, can you speak about Bitcoin as a power projection technology in detail? I really like to get Jason on to talk about that. I think there's things in that man's mind that aren't in his book. And I don't know if maybe we could get him on the air. I would love to get him on the air. I don't know if he's allowed to be on the air. He's kind of gone quiet mostly since the book disappeared from Amazon. You can get it for free in the public sector, in the public domain. It was made available in PDFs and what have you, but you can't buy it anymore. And I have a feeling somebody somewhere said, shut up. Texas Plant Company, the Trump EO today is a step one for a Bitcoin reserve. Same question. I don't know, man, because I haven't read the order. So there's no way. This is one thing I always try to do. I will speculate, but I don't speculate on things in ignorance. Like, I just don't do it. So it's, you're not wrong for answering the question. I can't answer yet. The new old man, Jack, where are you going right now in the garden for it? Do you think the last frost is behind us in Texas? I don't know. Historically speaking, we're in for at least one more good heavy freeze. It's real easy right now to feel like, hey, this is going to be a very early spring in Texas. I don't know. I'm not growing anything in the garden. I'm just starting my plants. I'm starting my tomatoes, my peppers, and things like that. I actually did an experiment this year. I bought some Fresno peppers to harvest seeds from the grocery store. I'm going to try to grow my Fresnos from seed saved from plants purchased right now. We got one more here, Scott. The Lords of Easy Money is also a great book to understand how the money system works. I'll have to check that out. I haven't. But I appreciate everybody that was here today. Real quick before I go, I want to let you guys know, again, my item of the day, because it is that time of year for starting plants, are the Barina LED grow lights in six packs. Let's see if my video quality still ass, and it is. So it is what it is. You can't really see the screen, but Barina LED grow lights, they are on sale now, and they have a 5% coupon. Instant coupon, check the box, you get another 5% off, and they're already knocked out about $10 a set. These are the best grow lights I found. If you are going to start plants this year, if you're in Texas, honestly, I'll have all of them started by the next weekend. I'm a little behind, right? If you're in Texas or Florida, you're already behind if you haven't done it yet, but there's still time. There's plenty of time. If you are like in North Carolina, Virginia, Pennsylvania, whatever, historically, my granddad always started his peppers and tomatoes around Valentine's Day. That's like 11 days away. So get your stuff set up. Get it going. I've got the nursery pots as well. Dr. Earth Fertilizer is great to get your plants off to a great start. The endomycorrhizal fungi, it's really a great product to add. After germination, biochar, all of it. Get on it, guys, because TikTok, the clock ticks for us all. We'll talk tomorrow about something else. I don't know yet, but it's probably going to be a single subject show tomorrow, not something like this. Stan says, one more question and we'll go. Would you agree with this math? Bitcoin equals USD plus USD inflation plus USD GDP plus wake up curve. No, I would not. I think you're making it way too complicated. I can't get real specific now at the end here, but I'm going to tell you it is this simple. The only question for the price of Bitcoin per Satoshi is, what does Bitcoin demonetize? What does it demonetize? What does it pull? Like, people talk about it demonetizing real estate. It is not going to demonetize real estate to zero. I'm sorry, it won't. People need places to live. There will always be people that don't want to buy a house or can't buy a house yet that need to rent. But it will demonetize a lot of investor money out of real estate because it's a better product for investing. The only reason it's not is right now, most people have to use their own money to buy Bitcoin, and you can use other people's money to buy real estate. That's what makes real estate attractive right now to people that aren't Michael Saylor. I can go find a house. I can do the math. I can put together a proposal. I can demonstrate that the rent money is there to service the debt. I can take my basic fucking credit. I can go to a bank. I can get a mortgage. I can buy the fucking house. And I can put a tenant in it. And I can have somebody else pay for my property while I artificially depreciate it against my income. I can generate cash flow with no taxes. That's what makes it attractive. The more it's possible for me to move my money into Bitcoin, the more you're going to demonetize that asset. So there's the concept of the world divided by 21 million. And that would be everybody's using Bitcoin all the time for everything. Could that happen? I'm not going to say anything can't happen given what Bitcoin's done, but I am not going to say that's going to happen anytime soon. I don't expect that I would live to see it. I'm in my 50s. I think that's more than a 50-year process. The question is, how much can it demonetize? that's how you look at the future value of Bitcoin. Right now, about the only thing that it's demonetizing, other than in special cases, like Michael Saylor type cases, is savings. It's about to eat, right? It's about to eat. Well, it already ate silver for market cap, but I think it keeps going back and forth. But it's going to eat gold as that resource. It's basically demonetizing investments right now. It's demonetizing stocks, right? It's not demonetizing what people are spending on coffee yet. And it's not really demonetizing real estate yet. But there's a lot of people in real estate that have a lot of real property that could cash out and move over. And they could sell either other investors that aren't ready yet, or they're just getting started. But one way or another, you start taking that capital out and moving it over, there's your future price action. And that's exciting if you really understand it. With that, I'll catch you tomorrow with another episode.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.